Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 390 of the Divine Intervention Podcasts. In today's podcast, we're going to be continuing the rapid review series for the USMLE Step 2 CK Step 3 exam. This is going to be episode series 74, but this is episode 390 of the podcast. Now, the thing I'm going to go ahead and say is if you're studying for Step 2 CK or Step 3, I do have two courses that may be of interest to you. I have the MBME Test Taking Strategies course, I guess maybe three courses. So the MBME Test Taking Strategies course is going to be taking place this Friday from 5 to 7:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And then on Saturday, I'm going to be having the first of the two-part 20-hour Step 2 CK Step 3 course. We're going to do 10 hours this Saturday and 10 hours the following Saturday. Basically, we're going to be meeting for 10 hours each day. We're going to cover neuro, IM, OB-GYN, psych, surgery, ethics, biostats, multi-systems, processes, and disorders, and a host of other subjects, communication, ethics, healthcare systems, and things like that. And then I have the second version of the DISC school taking place in the first 2 weeks of July. Basically, we meet for 8 hours for a day for 9 days, and then the final day we meet for 3 hours. I made a pretty detailed podcast on that about 2 days ago. That school has limited attendance. There's not a limited number of people for that. So if you're interested, just shoot me an email through the website if you want to sign up for any of these courses. Again, any of these courses will help you tremendously for your exams. I've had tons of people take these courses and they've done ridiculously well on their tests. So if you're interested, shoot me an email. There are definitely testimonials on my website. So just let me know. Again, if you see the way I teach on these podcasts, that'll be a very clear indication of what you're going to learn as we go through material during any of these courses. Okay, so what if they give you a question about a 45-year-old female? They tell you that for the last 3 weeks, she has had a dry cough and she's had some mild shortness of breath and exercise intolerance. And then they tell you that on physical exam, she has a rash on her cheeks that spares the nasolabial folds. And then, you know, they tell you that, of course, the MBME is in their wisdom. They'll give you some answers. They'll give you an answer that says lupus, and then they'll give you an answer that says sarcoidosis, and the right answer will be sarcoidosis. But you know, some people, they will focus really hard on the rash, on the cheeks, especially the nasolabial folds, and that's all they will focus on, right? But you remember, on these exams, you want to pick more encapsulating answers. This is going to be sarcoidosis. So let's talk about sarcoidosis. What in the world is happening with this patient? Well, again, you see a female dry cough. Although, remember, the MBMEs can give sarcoid to men, but classically, it's a female disease on exams, right? So what are the key things you want to know for your exams about sarcoidosis? Well, remember, sarcoid, they can have certain dermatologic manifestations. One of them is lupus pernio. Lupus pernio is the one I just described. It's literally a Miller rash, just like regular lupus, but you're going to find it in people that have sarcoidosis, right? So lupus pernio is a dermatologic manifestation of sarcoid. And then don't forget that on sarcoid, these people can also have erythema nodosum. Erythema nodosum is usually going to be on some extremity and it's going to be tender, right? It's a form of subcutaneous tissue inflammation, right? It's a form of panniculitis, right? So the two dermatologic manifestations, don't forget enodosum and don't forget lupus pernio. And actually, those dermatologic manifestations are prognostic indicators. People that have lupus pernio with sarcoid, they tend to do worse than people that have erythema nodosum with sarcoid. So with sarcoidosis, pretty high yield to know, right? These people typically, they're going to have like hilar lymphadenopathy. They're going to have sometimes interstitial infiltrates. Sarcoid, because it ends in osis, right? Sarcoidosis, that means they have a restrictive pattern of lung disease. Remember, I've said this so many times. Many times, whenever you have a disease that ends in the word osis, you have a restrictive disease of said organ, of that organ, right? So like, you know, sarcoidosis causes restrictive disease in the heart, right? I mean, in the lungs. So obviously, those people are going to have an FEV1 to FVC ratio that is normal or going to be increased, right? And, you know, since sarcoid can cause fibrotic lung disease, it would make sense that the AA gradient should be increased. Because if you think about it, when you have fibrosis of the lungs, then the oxygen that's inside the alveolar lumen is not going to be able to equilibrate with the oxygen that is in the pulmonary capillaries because there's an increased diffusion distance because of the fibrotic disease in the way. So that can certainly increase the AA gradient, right? And you should know, right, that the DLCO, the diffusion capacity, should be decreased. Well, why is that? Again, you're not going to be able to diffuse whenever you increase diffusion distance. right? Whenever you increase the vision distance, remember there's this rule that says that, I think of it as the DAT rule. For people that have dental school buddies, you know, they probably have to take the DAT. They probably have to take the DAT when they, to get into med school, the dental admissions test, right? So the D is the diffusibility. It's directly proportional to the A, that's the surface area for diffusion. And it's inversely proportional to the T, that's the thickness of diffusion, right? The thickness of the surface available for diffusion, right? So we know that diffusion can be affected by those things. And also, diffusion is also directly related to the pressure gradient, directly related to the pressure gradient. That's kind of how you ought to know. So if you think about it, in a disease like, in a fibrotic lung disease like sarcoidosis, the thickness is bigger. And we know that the thickness is inversely related to the diffusibility. So the thing that's going to happen is, since the thickness goes up, the diffusibility is going to go down because they're inversely related. But you think of a person that has been a heavy smoker or an alpha-1 antitrypsin patient where they have a ton of protease just chewing up their lungs. Well, your lung parenchyma is pretty much gone. When your lung parenchyma is gone, the surface area available for diffusion is going to be markedly decreased. Okay, so if you notice that diffusibility and surface area are directly related, as the surface area goes down, then your diffusibility is going to go down, right? They're directly related. So the mechanism behind the hypoxia or the reduced DLCO in a person that has emphysema, right, is a decrease in diffusion surface area. That's pretty high yield to know for exams. Again, the MBMEs these days, especially for step two, they're very big on these physiological scenarios. That's actually something I focus on pretty heavily during my courses, right? So let's go back to sarcoidosis though. So the DLCO is going to be decreased. The AA gradient is going to be increased, right? And remember, again, people that have sarcoidosis, many times they can have this thing where they can have arthritis, erythema nodosum, and the lung problems, right? So it's almost like a triad. So you see the person, they have erythema nodosum, they have arthritis, they have the lung issues like hilar lymphadenopathy and whatever. And that's what's called Lofgren syndrome, L-O-F-G-R-E-N, Lofgren syndrome. So how do we typically treat sarcoidosis on exams? Well, don't forget sarcoidosis. We're typically going to treat it with steroids. You give steroids, steroids can literally melt away a person's sarcoidosis. I mean, it doesn't mean it cannot recur, right? But it's pretty treatable when you give steroids. And, you know, by the way, sarcoid is a pretty high value subject, right? Because there's so many integrations. It's one of these things that can easily slot into the multi-systems processes and disorders section of the exam. Because you can slot it into so many things, right? Like, I'll give you a classic example. They can give you, like, for example, a person that has sarcoidosis, and you have like right upper quadrant pain. Well, that's sarcoid that has involved your liver. Remember, sarcoidosis, many times it involves the lungs, right? But it can absolutely involve a person's liver as well. They can have granulomas forming their liver, right? And those granulomas, we all know, not just the ones in the liver, the ones anywhere in the body, they contain macrophages. And those macrophages, surprise, surprise, express 1-alpha hydroxylase. Well, we know that 1-alpha hydroxylase's job is to convert inactive vitamin D, that's calcidiol from the liver, to active vitamin D, which is calcitriol from the kidneys. Remember, another name for calcidiol is 25-hydroxyvitamin D. And calcitriol, another name for it you may see on exams, is 1,25-dihydroxyvitamin D. So if you notice, well, from the liver, we get 25-hydroxy. From the kidneys, we produce 1,25-dihydroxy. That means something must have happened at the number one position to form that vitamin D. Well, enter 1-alpha hydroxylase. So that 1-alpha hydroxylase causes you to make active vitamin D, right? And it's gonna cause you to increase the reabsorption of calcium from your gut. So you're gonna have hypercalcemia. So remember, hypercalcemia is a pretty classic feature of sarcoidosis on MBME exams. Again, because they have hypervitaminosis D. A very classic question they can ask you. And typically, right, people that have sarcoid, they're gonna have an increase in their LDH, their lactate dehydrogenase is gonna be increased. Well, again, if you think of why, whenever you have so much inflammation and cell death, right? Remember, lactate dehydrogenase is an intracellular enzyme. So whenever a lot of cells are dying quickly, right, you're going to have an increase in your LDH. So that's just like a concept. Instead of just memorizing that, wow, increased LDH is specific for sarcoid, you can just tie it together with many other things, right? Like if a person has tumor lysis syndrome, for example, their LDH is going to be up. Why? Because you're killing a lot of tumor cells, especially with these leukemias and lymphomas. Like Burkitt's, for example, is a pretty prime candidate. You're killing a lot of cells. As you're killing them, they're going to spill their lactate dehydrogenase into the serum. And also remember, in sarcoidosis, you're going to have an increase in your ACE, in your angiotensin-converting enzyme. Again, these things are all high yield to know. And don't forget, people that have sarcoid, they can absolutely get heart block on exams because, again, they can form granulomas in the conducting system. And those granulomas in the conducting system can absolutely cause them to have a heart block. Remember, when people have heart blocks, there are certain drugs that you should not give them. Because if you have heart blocks, your AV node is not working well already. It doesn't make any sense to give any drug that's going to block your AV node. Again, these are ways they can make these integrations on your exams, right? So, for example, they can give you a person, right? You shouldn't put those people on beta blockers, right? That would not be a stellar idea at all, because beta blockers are going to slow conduction down the AV node. Remember, those are class 2 antiarrhythmics. You also don't want to give these people the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, right? So drugs like verapamil or diltiazem, because they're going to slow conduction down the AV node. That would not be a good idea as well, right? Remember, those are your class 4 antiarrhythmics. You don't want to give them something like digoxin, because if you give them something like digoxin, yes, it increases cardiac contractility by inhibiting the sodium-potassium ATPase pump. But digoxin also increases vagal tone. Digoxin is a muscarinic receptor agonist. It will not be good for people that have, AV nodal disease. And remember, when people have AV node blocks, you know, Mobitz 2 and type 3 heart blocks, those people get pacemakers. But Mobitz 1, which is the first kind of, that's the Winky Bach. Mobitz 1, which is the first type of a second degree heart block. And the first degree heart blocks, those people don't get pacemakers. They will only get pacemakers if they're symptomatic as a result of the heart block, right? So again, just make sure you know as many things as you can about sarcoidosis. It's something they love to test, right? Or they can even give you a question about a person that has sarcoidosis and they have like eye pain or visual difficulty. Then what's going to be your next step? Well, your next step is going to be ophthalmologic evaluation. Because remember, people that have sarcoid, they can absolutely get uveitis. They can get anterior uveitis. This is very high yield to know. They can get anterior uveitis. Right? Anterior uveitis is absolutely a manifestation of sarcoidosis. In fact, our friends at the MBMEs, they can easily give you a question on the exam. And they can say, oh, you know, in a person that has just gotten a new diagnosis of sarcoid, what's the next best step? Well, the thing is, when people get a new diagnosis of sarcoidosis, there are a few tests you're supposed to get in these people, right? So you're supposed to get a chest x-ray because, you know, these people, again, they can have the hilar lymphadenopathy. It can just help you see whatever lung disease they have. And for these people as well, not a bad idea to get an EKG because, again, they can have heart blocks because you don't know if the granulomas have involved their conducting system, right? They can even get restrictive heart disease, believe it or not. People that have sarcoid, again, remember it ends in osis, so it can cause restrictive heart disease because those granulomas can deposit in the myocardium. It can deposit amongst the myocardial cells, and that can absolutely cause problems for those people, right? So people that have a new diagnosis of sarcoidosis, they're going to get a chest x-ray. They're going to get an EKG. You're going to get PFTs on those people, right? You're going to get PFTs on those people. And those PFTs, again, because you just want to see if they have, if they've gotten all the way down to restrictive lung disease. And then it will also be helpful to get LFTs on those people because, again, sarcoid has a very good predilection for a person's liver. It can cause LFT elevations. Another disease, so I guess I'll say I'm officially done with sarcoid, but another disease that has like a similar set of, you got to keep this in mind when you're starting, it's probably more medication, is if you're studying a person on amiodarone, not a bad idea to get PFTs, look at the way their lungs work, LFTs, look at the way their liver works, and TFTs, because remember, amiodarone, look at the name, amiodarone, right, iodo, it contains iodine, it can cause both hypothyroidism, and it can also cause hyperthyroidism. If you remember in past podcasts, I've described this whole iod base dow, J-O-D, base dow is B-A-S-E-D-O-W, like the Dow index for the stock market. So iod base dow, and then there's the Wolff-Chaikoff. Chaikoff is spelled C-H-A-I-K-O-F-F, Wolff-Chaikoff. The Wolf is W-O-L-F-F, the Wolff-Chaikoff effects. Those are effects that explain how sarcoidosis can cause both hypo or hyperthyroidism. Amiodarone can cause both hyper or hypothyroidism, right? I remember amiodarone is one of these high-value drugs. You use it for many things on exams, right? You can use it for AFib when you're pursuing a rhythm control strategy. Remember, you can use either rate control or rhythm control for AFib, right? But again, we use it in the rhythm control strategy. So for amiodarone, you're going to do PFTs, you're going to do LFTs, you're going to do TFTs when you're studying people on those medications. And then remember, you also want to get like baseline, like echocardiograms when you're studying people on these cardiotoxic medications, right? So things like donodoxorubicin, those anti-cancer agents. Remember, those things, they can precipitate the Fenton reaction, so they can cause free radical damage of your myocardium and all those badness, right? But also baseline echocardiograms, not a bad idea as well in people that are being placed on trastuzumab. Remember, trastuzumab is a breast cancer medication. It's something we use in people that have those HER2 mutations, HER2 new, right? You want to use trastuzumab. Trastuzumab is extremely helpful in those people because, again, it blocks those receptors. It's a monoclonal antibody. But unfortunately, trastuzumab can cause a reversible dilated cardiomyopathy, unlike doxorubicin that causes an irreversible dilated cardiomyopathy, right? So before you put people on those medications, you need to get baseline echocardiograms in those people. And then don't forget, if we're going into the world of psych, not a bad idea to check CBCs quite frequently in people that are on clozapine. Remember, clozapine is a third-line agent for the management of schizophrenia. You're going to give it to a person that you've tried all the usual stuff for schizophrenia, none of those things are working, right? Then you're going to go for clozapine. But remember, clozapine can absolutely cause agranulocytosis. So it'll be a person that can present with like neutropenic fever on NBME exams. In those circumstances, right, you want to, when people are placed on clozapine, you got to put those people on, you got to check their CBCs regularly, because again, they can have really, really bad agranulocytosis, and that can be pretty life-threatening, right? So, and just remember, antipsychotics in general, again, you don't always have to do this, but on exams, a potential question could be that you want to get an EKG before you start people on antipsychotics, especially ziprasidone, right? Of all the antipsychotics, remember, ziprasidone is the one, I think that's called Geodon in the hospitals. And ziprasidone has the very unique ability to prolong your QT interval. But remember, pretty much any antipsychotic can prolong your QT, right? So again, you may be surprised, you can just get this nondescript question on your exam where you're like, huh, okay, this person is being studied on an antipsychotic. And then they ask for, like, the stuff you're expecting with antipsychotics as answers, you're not seeing any of it, right? And the answer may just be, oh, get an EKG, right? Because again, those things prolong the QT interval. So again, these are just all kind of high-yield things you want to make sure you know and know well for your exam. And then, what if they give you a question about a patient, and they tell you that this patient, you know, for the last 5 weeks, he has become more and more forgetful, and they tell you that he has been having, like, intermittent shortness of breath. So he's become more and more forgetful. He's been having intermittent shortness of breath. He has been having a lot of diarrhea. And then they tell you that he has been having this rash. They can even show you an image that he has a rash on the palms, has a rash on the soles, and you see all those things, right? And then you read the question, you're like, man, how do I put all of this together? Well, let's put it all together. And they can even tell you that you hear a murmur in his heart that increases your inspiration. When you see stuff like that, you should really think about this person having pellagra as a result of carcinoid syndrome. So let's explain. Now, the thing is, pellagra, right, is a niacin deficiency. Okay. Well, we know that niacin is also known as vitamin B3. Okay. Well, we know that niacin is not made out of thin air. Niacin is made from a compound called tryptophan. Right. Niacin is made from a compound called tryptophan. So we know that tryptophan is a pretty ubiquitous molecule. It can be used to make many things on exams. You can use it to make niacin, right? Which is vitamin B3. You can use it to make serotonin. In fact, another name for serotonin is 5-HT, 5-hydroxytryptophan, right? So, in fact, there's this enzyme I believe is known as tryptophan hydroxylase that converts tryptophan to serotonin. So, when a person has a deficiency of vitamin B3 or niacin, they're going to have what we call pellagra. Pellagra, the classic findings are going to be diarrhea, dermatitis, and dementia. So if you notice, this person has diarrhea, although their diarrhea could also just be caused by them having carcinoid syndrome, which we'll talk about in a bit. But they can have diarrhea, they have dermatitis, right? So they'll have a rash. Again, it can be a rash that you see on the extremities, right? So they can have diarrhea, they can have dermatitis, they can have dementia. Right? You can have dementia as a result of this problem, right? So those are all things you can see in a person that has B3 deficiency. And obviously, if he goes on for long enough and you don't treat it, the person is going to die, which is unfortunate. So how does carcinoid syndrome cause a person to have pellagra? Well, remember, in carcinoid, you have a tumor that is most commonly in the appendix that produces a lot of serotonin. So because you're making so much serotonin, you're going to divert pretty much all the tryptophan you take into the body into producing serotonin. So there's less available, right? If you think in terms of the Le-Chatelier's principle, this is something you probably learned in general chemistry back in the day in college. As you're driving more tryptophan, you know, through tryptophan hydroxylase towards serotonin, then you don't have enough tryptophan available to make niacin. So you're going to have a niacin deficiency, right? So that's how people that have carcinoid, they can get a niacin deficiency. So carcinoid, remember, These people, the classic symptoms you find in carcinoid syndrome, you can remember them with the mnemonic BFDR. BFDR. FDR was a pretty famous president in the US, if I'm not mistaken. I believe it's Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So FDR. So the B stands for bronchospasm, right? The B stands for bronchospasm. The F stands for flushing. The D stands for diarrhea. And the R stands for right-sided heart lesions, right? So this person I described in this question, though, for them to be having like the bronchospastic features, that means the tumor is no longer in the appendix. That means the tumor has metastasized to the liver. Because remember, if the tumor is in the appendix, you're not going to be symptomatic because the liver has the ability to break down serotonin so that you don't get the deleterious effects all over the body. And remember, the appendix has the ability to drain into the liver through the portovenous system. But when the tumor metastasizes to the person's liver, then you can start elaborating those nasty, you can start elaborating the serotonin, and you can have the systemic effects, right? So, you know, they can get bronchospasm, right? So they can get the bronchospasm, they can get the flushing, they can get the diarrhea. And the right-sided heart symptoms they get is, again, because the agents released from the carcinoid tumor can absolutely torch the right side of a person's heart. Many times it can cause valvular problems. It can cause, like, tricuspid insufficiency, right? That's tricuspid regurge and pulmonic stenosis. You can remember that with the mnemonic TIPS, right? Tricuspid insufficiency, pulmonic stenosis. So you may wonder, Divine, why does this thing not go after the left side of the heart? Well, it doesn't, because your pulmonary capillaries are heavily metabolic organs. They have the ability to break down serotonin. So they will break it down. So you're not going to get that active metabolite in the person's left side of their heart. So that's why these people classically are not going to have any problems in the left side of the heart. That's very high yield to know. So how do we diagnose sarcoid carcinoid? Well, on exams, typically, you're going to look for a breakdown product. You're going to look at 5-HIAA. I believe it's like 5-hydroxyindole acetic acid, 5-HIAA. It's a breakdown product of serotonin. It's going to be elevated in the serum of people that have carcinoid syndrome, right? It's going to be elevated in serum of people that have carcinoid syndrome. And obviously, if a person has carcinoid syndrome, you want to treat it by, you know, getting rid of the mass. But another drug you may see on exams is telotrestat. Telotrestat is a tryptophan hydroxylase inhibitor. So you're going to prevent the conversion of tryptophan to serotonin, right? And again, just one last thing I'll say with 5-HIAA levels. Remember, it's going to be low. If you do a lumbar puncture on people that have like suicidal ideation, people that have depression, right? Those people are going to have low serotonin, right? That's one of the reasons why we give SSRIs, SNRIs for the management of depression. These people, if you check their CSF, they actually have low levels of serotonin or its metabolite, 5-HIAA. That's just a very nice psychiatric integration there. So I'm going to go ahead and pause. Again, as I do at the end of every podcast, I offer one-on-one tutoring for all the USMLE exams, although that's much more limited now. If you want one-on-one tutoring with me, something you have to book like weeks in advance. I tutor for step one, step two CK, step three, preclinical med school exams, third year shelf exams. I do offer the review courses for step two CK and step three, and also, obviously, they apply to complex level two and three. That's the 20-hour course, the MBME testing and strategies course, and the DISC school, the 75-hour school that I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast. And then I do also offer consulting with ERAS applications like personal statements, recommendation letters, mock interviews, and things like that. Editing your ERAS application, your supplemental application. If that's something you're interested in, just shoot me an email through the website and I can give you some more information on any of these services. And then I have the podcast on all the major podcast apps, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, at least the most recent 150. If you want everything from episode 1 all the way to 390, which is this present podcast, you have to go on the website, divineinterventionpodcasts.com, and you'll see everything. You don't have to do any sign up. Although, if you have a WordPress account and you sign up for my website, you'll get an email notification whenever I make a new podcast, which for some people is quite helpful. And then I have a new website called divineinterventionlifelessons.com. On that website, I make some life lessons podcasts that are Bible-based. They're about 10 minutes long for most of them. And I discuss like a common problem that faces humanity or would very likely be applicable to a medical student from a biblical perspective. In fact, I have the podcast on Apple Podcasts. It's called the Divine Intervention Life Lessons Podcast. So if that's something you're interested in, again, just check that out. Again, I suspect you're going to find it to be pretty helpful. So thank you for listening to me today. Have a wonderful rest of your day. I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.